It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than half of Americans say that talking about politics with people they disagree with is generally stressful and frustrating. That's according to Pew Research Center. Days away from a contentious presidential election, are there any issues where Wisconsinites can find common ground? A project by the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs aims to find out, holding a series of community forums around the state. And the final town hall is today on the topic of inflation. The leader of the Main Street Agenda Project joins us now. Susan Yockey is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, where she's a professor of American politics. Susan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
I'm delighted to be here, Kate.
Well, today's town hall in Milwaukee will explore people's attitudes toward inflation. You know, inflation worries voters. It's been the focus of events on the presidential campaign trail. How will you explore this issue?
We're really excited to be at the Clinton Rose Senior Center today in Milwaukee. We're going to explore it in a couple different ways. So first, we're going to have two faculty members, so two kind of experts in the area of inflation from the La Follette School of Public Affairs here at UW-Madison, go to Milwaukee and talk about their research and the trends in the data. So my colleagues, Professor Menzie Chin, as well as my colleague, Michael Collins, will be in Milwaukee. And alongside them will also be two kind of local citizen leaders in the Milwaukee area, and they're going to be sharing their perspective and the perspective of kind of Milwaukee citizens on how inflation has impacted them.
In terms of inflation, people feel like the pandemic issues still feel very raw, very real. How does that factor into public policy, factor in people's views about inflation heading into the November election?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that we've been trying to explore in advance of the 2024 election. So the La Follette School of Public Affairs has partnered with the UW Survey Center on campus to survey Wisconsinites about the public policy issues that matter to them in advance of the election. And we're really excited to do this work, in part because our observation is that a lot of the surveys that go out are about who's up, who's down. You know, it's very much the horse race coverage.
Yeah.
But a lot of Wisconsinites want to talk about the issues. And we've done this with a representative survey sample of Wisconsinites, about 3,500 Wisconsinites all across the state, all different political persuasions, all ages, all races. And what we've returned back is some really interesting findings on the public policy issues that matter to Wisconsinites. Inflation was at the top of the list, which is why it made so much sense for this event in Milwaukee.
And people participate in this Wisconsin survey on a somewhat regular basis. How effective is that to continually, you know, touch base with the survey respondents to see what is on their mind?
You know, it's a really important way to think about changes in citizen attitudes. And that is this Wisconsin survey. It's really a gem here hosted at UW-Madison through our UW Survey Center. And it goes back to a representative, again, that's a key part, representative panel of Wisconsinites on about a monthly basis. And what that means is that the same Wisconsinites are sharing their views and perspectives in January and then in February and March. So they're oftentimes replying on different questions, but you can also ask those Wisconsinites the same question at different points, different months, and then see if there's any changes across time. And that's really important for us to understand the trends in some of these public policy issues in ways that just kind of like one-off surveys or polls can't provide that insight into.
What have the trend lines, showed you? What have you seen maybe bounce around or not hold steady?
Yeah, I mean, great question. So, you know, one of the issues that's, you know, top of mind for a lot of Wisconsinites that does bounce around a little bit is gun violence. So that would be one that I think can be responsive to things that are happening in the broader community, the state, or in our case, the country. And that's something that bounces around. Inflation in contrast, is something that's pretty darn sticky. That has been, since the beginning of the Wisconsin survey, something that has shown a lot of staying power in the minds of Wisconsinites.
And it was interesting, too, I think it was way back maybe in 2022, where three quarters of Wisconsin residents felt gun violence is quite or an extremely big problem in America. You know, was it surprising to see gun violence as a top national issue at one point?
Yeah, you know, it's an important issue here in Wisconsin, too. And I think it's I think most Wisconsinites recognize and understand that inflation is a big issue coming into the 2024 election. But gun violence is a little bit different, right? I don't know that all Wisconsinites would necessarily recognize that it is such an important issue to their fellow citizens as well as to the nation as a whole.
We're talking with Susan Yockey, director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and on a project called the Main Street Agenda. Susan, your school has hosted a number of in-person community conversations around specific policy issues to get people sharing their perspectives and to help people talk to each other who maybe wouldn't normally cross paths. What have you learned from these events?
Yeah, we have really worked hard in advance of this 2024 election to get Wisconsinites talking to each other in a way that we never have as a school in the past. And so let me tell you about four different events that we have held on consecutive Wednesdays across Wisconsin. So these are events in Pewaukee, Green Bay, Eau Claire, and then here in Madison. And these events in total brought together just under 350 Wisconsinites. And across the partisan aisle, and these were folks that were selected from a representative group of Wisconsinites. And so the folks that attended our events are, you know, drawn from this Wisconsin sample that we talked about earlier. And the format for the event is a little different. Like, so today, our event in Milwaukee is going to be a town hall where we're going to hear from experts and community leaders kind of sitting in front of on a stage and talking with a group of community members and asking questions. And that's a really important kind of town hall event mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. we do at La Follette. We had a similar one in La Crosse, for instance, on September 11th. But the four events, the community events, conversation events that I'm talking about, were different. They were, think of it like a round table sitting about 7 or 8 Wisconsinites, some Republicans, some independents and Dems at every table, and a trained nonpartisan facilitator who came from the La Follette School, one of our students, faculty, or staff. And there was 2 hours where those folks got to talk to each other in a kind of facilitated way, moderated way, about the public policy issues that matter to them. So they got together over dinner on La Follette, right? Mm-hmm. So we paid for dinner. We kind of broke bread together and tried to show that we can, as a community, have respectful and civil conversations with our other community members, folks that we don't know, and very often folks that have differing views.
And you've said before that you were not looking to change people's views or change people's values during these community conversations. Why do these discussions have merit in the policymaking process if no one is changing their mind on issues?
Yeah, you know, we need to be able to talk to each other to get to the mission of the La Follette School, which is evidence-based policymaking. So evidence-based policymaking oftentimes takes political compromise. And we just can't get to political compromise if people can't talk to each other anymore. So I'm thinking about a quote that one of our participants, George, shared with us after attending one of these dinner and conversation events. And he said, quote, "It's okay to have a difference of opinion and still agree on the fact that we want to have a better Wisconsin." I think that quote really shows that, you know, this individual who came to one of our events and like pretty much everybody that was invited was a little dubious. They're like, "What is this? what is this thing?" They were not so sure what to expect. But many people came away saying how refreshed they were, how excited they were, wanting to do more events. They're wondering if we would hold another event. So we even had some hugs. We had people that didn't know each other before the event that left and, you know, hugged each other, and, you know, that wasn't everybody and it wasn't all roses. But we were able to demonstrate through these type of events that our little circles that oftentimes define us, our individual media markets, our communities that don't have us encountering people of a different political persuasion, can be broken down through events like this.
It makes me wonder, Susan, seeing hugs, I mean, how bad is the echo chamber? How bad is it that people just aren't hearing one another?
One of our participants, Joshua, said, here's another quote from him, people feel, I think, like they don't have an outlet to do this kind of thing outside of their little circles, which these days are smaller than ever. So I think, everyone recognizes that this is happening, but I don't know that we fully put a finger on the fact that it changes our attitudes and assessments of the other, the quote other. It's just so easy to demonize people that think differently when you don't interact with them on a daily basis, when you don't sit down and break bread with them and have civil conversations. And it's just a lot harder to do when the person is across the table from you and is largely agreeing with, your general values or your thoughts, even if they might have a different policy prescription or might vote for the other side.
In our final moments together, Susan, do you think the Main Street Agenda Project is making a difference, and is it able to do what you intended it to do?
Well, we had a couple goals for the Main Street Agenda, and one was to talk about the issues that matter to people in advance of the 2024 election. And we've undoubtedly checked that box. I mean, we're getting across Wisconsin. We brought, about 20 of our faculty, staff, and students all across the state, talking about the issues that matter in communities. So I feel really great about that. Mm. But this wasn't just an outreach event for the LaSalle School. It was also a research event. LaSalle is one of the top public policy schools in the country, and we want to study as well how these events could be more meaningful. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to study these events and try to share some of these best practices with other nonprofit organizations that want to hold dinner and conversation events.
Susan Yockey, director of the Follett School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. And for disclosure, Wisconsin Public Radio is a partner organization on the Main Street Agenda Project. Coming up, a tobacco researcher in Wisconsin studies the changes that occur in the body at the moment someone decides to vape.
Your smartwatch can beep at you and say, hey, your heart rate's going up. Make sure you're making healthy choices.
The latest on smoking interventions, that's just ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Political campaigns in Wisconsin can be close, so any voting bloc could decide the next election. But the influence of suburban voters has grown, partly because they've shown a willingness to change their minds. As WPR's Sean Johnson reports, that's been the case in Waukesha County, where both parties are competing for votes.
Volunteers worked fast to set up metal folding chairs on a recent Thursday evening at the Southminster Presbyterian Church in Waukesha. Almost as quickly as they're added, people fill the rows of seats. Amid the cacophony, the church's PA system crackles to life with an announcement.
Welcome to the
monthly meeting of the Waukesha County Democratic Party is about to start. There's a guest speaker tonight. Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez is from the county. She says she brags about the standing room only crowds at these meetings to Democrats in other parts of the state.
It is so exciting to me to see this level of commitment.
In the crowd is Chris Bethy from Pewaukee. She says she remembers when she moved to the suburbs 20 years ago.
We felt like we were the only Democrats in the whole county. And now I know most of these people sitting here believe that same thing. Until you start going to meetings and talking to people, and then you realize you're not alone.
County Party Chair Matt Moreno says it's taken years of work for Democrats to get to this point. But he says the suburbs are changing, and it gives the party an opening.
If we invest in this community, we block the Republicans from ever having a statewide victory in Wisconsin because we're undermining the heartbeat of the Republican Party in Wisconsin.
For decades, the Republican formula for winning Wisconsin relied on running up the numbers in Waukesha County and neighboring suburbs. This area was the foundation of the GOP's power in the state. Former Assembly Speaker Scott Jensen represented part of Waukesha as a Republican legislator from 1992 to 2006.
I frequently got as much as 78% of the vote when I represented this area. Today, that same territory now leans slightly towards the Democrats.
Jensen says around a decade ago, Democrats got more active, knocking on doors and putting up yard signs.
Before, they would just give up and try to rack up the numbers in Madison and Milwaukee. Now they realize they can win some of these areas, and they have been doing that.
Part of the reason both parties campaign here now is the mix of voters. You could find a sample of that at the city of Waukesha's recent Oktoberfest celebration. The county is still mostly conservative voters, like Ross Van Evenhoven of Brookfield. He says he's voting for former President Donald Trump, despite some of the stuff Trump says.
I look at it more of the policies are what's important. I could really care less what he says on a day-to-day basis. It's what he actually does.
There are undecided voters, like Randy Johanning of Waukesha, who doesn't talk about politics much.
I keep my mouth shut. So I listen. That's my thing.
And there are Democratic voters like Anna Marie Vassalotti of Waukesha, who says she's supporting Vice President Kamala Harris. Vassalotti says she knows some Republicans are considering doing the same thing this year.
And it may not have changed their true political beliefs at heart, but at this particular election, they may choose to vote differently.
For Democrats, a best-case scenario in this election might be to crack 40% of the vote across the county. That may seem modest, but in a county the size of Waukesha, it changes the political calculus for Wisconsin. When it comes to why this is happening, there are a couple schools of thought. Trump's influence on the suburban vote can't be ignored. Since he arrived on the scene, Republicans' numbers have dropped in suburbs across the country. But suburbs like Waukesha County are also going through demographic changes. Moreno, with the County Democratic Party, says that could have lasting implications.
Yes, the next election is really important, but in Waukesha, we need to be thinking about the next five elections because that's where we're heading and that's what we need to focus on.
Republicans, like Jensen, think the right messages could bring back their commanding margins. But right now, neither party can take the suburbs for granted. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today. About 4.7 million young adults in the U.S. have used an e-cigarette to vape nicotine, according to the federal government's most recent national survey on drug use and health. A study finds an e-cigarette user's heart rate increases before taking a nicotine hit. That finding could help lead to new ways to support young adults trying to quit. Study co-author Megan Piper is a director of research at the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention and a professor in the UW Department of Medicine. Megan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In this study, you had young people who vape wear devices that monitored their heart rates. Can you tell us about the idea behind the study?
Sure. I'm sure you know, when you do something a lot of times every day, you don't always know exactly when you're doing it or how often you're doing it. And what we really wanted to understand was how often these young adults were actually using their e-cigarettes. There's what they tell you they think that they do, and then there's what they actually do based on feedback we can get from wearable devices like a smartwatch.
How does a heart rate change when a person is getting ready to vape?
Well, that was really interesting. We were hoping we would be able to see some kind of physiological reaction to anticipation or getting ready to hit a vape. And what we found, in fact, is that you do get an increase in heart rate that may signal what we're hypothesizing signals, anticipation or getting ready to have that opportunity for nicotine.
Does the heart rate then fall after the vaping event? What do you find when you look at the, you know, the before and after?
Sure. So it does come back down. And of course, when you put nicotine into your body, it does increase your heart rate. That's one of the effects that nicotine has on your body. And so basically how much nicotine you're having, how many times you hit the device, those are different variables that'll affect how quickly your heart rate returns to normal.
How important is this wearable technology to really help advance the research you're doing in trying to help people quit smoking?
It's really important because what it can do is it can provide critical information that you might not be aware of. If you think about vaping or smoking and you are thinking, oh, in a little bit, I'm going to take a break from whatever I'm doing, or, oh, I'm starting to get a craving or an urge to smoke, and your smartwatch can beep at you and say, hey, your heart rate's going up. Make sure you're making healthy choices. Make sure you're making a thoughtful choice about what you're going to do right now. If you're trying to quit smoking or you're trying to quit vaping, this is an opportunity to call a friend, play a game on your phone, use a piece of nicotine gum, use a nicotine lozenge, something other than doing the thing you're trying not to do, which might be smoking or vaping.
Megan, do you find that researchers like yourself are really focused on these technology interventions for young adult e-cigarette users?
We do. We find that, you know, the young adults, so 18 to 25 or thereabouts, they're tech natives. They are interested in using wearable devices. People track their steps. They track their, activity levels. They gamify it so that they're trying to earn particular levels at different times. This makes changing behaviors really engaging. And when you can be more engaged and have maybe a fun component to it, it makes it that much easier to do something really hard, like quitting smoking or quitting vaping.
You're looking at these young adults, you said 18 to 25. What do you know about the demographics of people who vape?
Well, we definitely know that young adults are the largest group of vapers compared to older adults or compared even to high school age or even younger. That 18 to 24, 25-year-old demographics vapes at the highest rate in this country. We also see really high vaping rates among certain subgroups. So people who endorse being LGBTQ+, vape at much higher rates. We see higher rates of vaping sometimes among people with different mental illness. And we also see higher rates of vaping in people in higher socioeconomic classes.
And you write in your study that most young people who vape plan to quit one day, but that motivation to quit is low and that there's not always adequate support for quitting. I want to unpack that. First of all, why is motivation to quit so low?
For a lot of young adults, what they're doing now doesn't seem like what they're planning to do in the future. They're very focused on the here and now, and they don't necessarily think about long-term consequences or how nicotine dependence is rewiring their brain, making it less likely for them to be able to quit in the future. And so if you ask most young adults, you know, do you think you'll be smoking in the future? Do you think you'll be vaping in the future? Do you think you'll be drinking like this in the future or using any other substances? Most of them, they don't even see that future, but they really don't identify as a smoker or a vapor. And so they don't see it themselves doing it in the future. The problem is when you're dealing with a substance as addictive as nicotine, that dependence builds early and makes it that much harder to be, you know, smoke-free or vape-free as you move into later adulthood.
And also then support to quit. You said it's a limited in your research. What is missing in the support systems to help young adults quit?
So one of the hardest things right now is there are a lot of different services available, but the question becomes, where's the evidence? Right? Vaping is relatively new. And so the treatment research is trying to catch up. And so at this point now, we do have different resources that people can use to help quit vaping. There's an intervention called This Is Quitting that is an online intervention, and it allows people to interact with other folks trying to quit vaping and get support in that way. And there's also been new research showing that medications like varenicline, which is the generic version of Chantix, actually help people quit vaping as well. So I think what happens sometimes is what started as a social thing or something to feel good or relax became an addiction. And then people feel sort of stuck and isolated, and they don't know where to reach out or how to get help. And so one of the things we're trying to do is connect people with help for that by referring them to the Wisconsin Quit Line, by referring them to This Is Quitting and other online programs.
Is the Quit Line keeping up with the changing dynamics of technology and people's preferences in using a digital approach?
Oh, definitely. Yes, the Quit Line has different options for people so that if they don't want to talk to anybody, they don't have to. They can text READY to 34191, and that will help them get enrolled in tobacco Quit Line services that could be helpful with smoking or vaping or whatever they're interested in finding more information about.
We're talking with Megan Piper, Director of Research at the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at the latest developments to stop vaping and smoking. Megan, what is the typical experience of a young person trying to quit vaping based on what you've seen in your work?
So what we see and hear a lot is people now feel addicted, right? When they've been using long enough, they start to feel addicted. They talk about fiending or feeling nic sick or other descriptive words for nicotine withdrawal. And they don't like that. They don't like the amount of money they spend doing it. They don't like the fact that they're hitting their vape constantly all day long, and they want to change. But sometimes that kind of change is really hard, right? Because you're dealing with an addiction. And so they try and they might not be successful. They try, and it's incredibly difficult, and they just can't sustain it.
Looking ahead to new studies, the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention received a $4.3 million grant from the National Cancer Institute to look at helping people who both smoke and vape to quit, and you're calling this dual users. Can you talk about this research?
Sure. A lot of people who smoke thought when e-cigarettes came around, well, this might be a healthier way to get my nicotine, and maybe it'll help me quit. But what happens is we have a lot of people in this country that are stuck in this dual-use pattern where sometimes they're smoking, but they're also vaping, maybe in places where they can't smoke. And the problem is that recent research has come out showing that there's a fourfold increase in lung cancer if you are stuck in this long-term dual-use pattern. And so what we really wanted to do was to take interventions that we know help people quit smoking and see if we could modify them, adjust them so that they'd be really effective for people who are dual users. So we're looking to help people who smoke and vape really focus on quitting smoking and seeing the best way that they can do that.
And this is exciting because, as I understand, there haven't been studies to find effective methods to help these dual users quit. Why is that such a challenging problem?
I think, you know, like I mentioned earlier, that the research is just catching up with how people are using e-cigarettes. And what we know now is that, people are established in this dual-use pattern. And so we really need to catch up the research on how to help people where they are. Very few people these days just smoke cigarettes. A lot of them are using lots of different types of tobacco products. And this is where we really feel like we need to understand the best ways to help people.
I'm wondering, what is the nicotine impact on dual users, people who are both smoking cigarettes and vaping?
That's one of the questions our research is hoping to answer. How much nicotine are you actually taking into your system if you're smoking and vaping? And then once we have that information, it'll help us understand, is that why a nicotine patch might work better for some? Or is it the situation where somebody who's taking in a lot of nicotine because they're getting it from both different products, maybe those folks do much better with a pill like a Chantix, otherwise known as varenicline.
This will be a year-long study, is that right?
Participants will be involved for 1 year.
Okay.
The grant itself is 5 years long so that we can help as many people as we can in Wisconsin to do this. We are just getting started. So right now, people can sign up at avenuesstudy.com and learn more about the study and find out if you might be eligible to participate.
With wearable devices and other ways of really charting accurate information on how people are both smoking and using e-cigarettes, do you feel like you are on the cusp of some new breakthroughs in helping people quit nicotine for good?
That would be fantastic. That would absolutely be, that would be a dream come true, I think, for all tobacco scientists. If we could finally harness technology in such a way that we could help people achieve their goal of being tobacco free, that would be an ideal situation.
Do you feel with vaping products somewhat new on the scene, has that complicated your efforts as a researcher to ultimately help people stop smoking?
Yes and no. It has definitely complicated the situation when you think about people who are existing smokers and who get stuck in this dual use pattern. In some respects, e-cigarettes have been shown to be helpful in helping people quit smoking as long as they only use the e-cigarettes. There's evidence that they can be as effective as things like the nicotine patch. But you can't get stuck in that dual pattern. You have to completely switch. And so e-cigarettes have been a complicated evolution in nicotine products, in addition because of the issue of youth uptake. Right? Having youth and young adults starting vaping because it tastes good. It's a great high. You can do it discreetly. It's cool. All of the advertising that was done to really focus on youth and young adults access, all of those things have made e-cigarettes a much more complicated product when it comes to tobacco control.
Do you think the public health messages are getting through, especially for young people, about how dangerous it is to vape?
I think they are. We are seeing falling rates of e-cigarette use in young adults and high school students as well. Kids get that you can become addicted to e-cigarettes now, and they understand the dangers. Doesn't mean they think it'll happen to them. Doesn't mean they think it'll happen, if they use it for a while. But the notion that it's a completely safe product, I believe, has evolved.
Megan, thank you for your research. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Megan Piper is Director of Research at the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, sharing her latest study on quitting smoking and vaping.
Coming up, a Wisconsin author shares his new book set in small town Wisconsin and breaking stereotypes about small town life.
If anything, this book is about shattering that myth that rural communities are monoliths. There's a line in the book, everybody thinks everybody knows everybody in small towns, and everybody's wrong.
It's Mike McCabe with Miracles Along County Q coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The differences between urban and rural parts of the state get a lot of attention in the political sphere, but we don't always hear as much about what life is actually like in small-town Wisconsin. It's the setting for a new novel about growing up in a fictional rural community near Eau Claire in the late 90s and early 2000s. It's not a political story, but the book shows us how characters in the small town work through issues of identity, sexuality, and economic changes along the way. Mike McCabe is former executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. His debut novel is called Miracles Along County Q. Mike, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. You have been a journalist in Wisconsin. You've been involved in politics as a watchdog on campaign finance. And now here comes a fiction book, and not like a political thriller or anything. What took you into writing a small town piece of fiction for Wisconsin?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with politics. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is that though I'm very proud of the work I've done over the years, we're living in a moment where what ails our society the most can't be cured at the Capitol. The biggest problems facing us, the dishonesty, the divisiveness, the demonization, the dehumanization that we see in our society, these are matters of the heart, and those problems can't be solved through politics. And I think art is actually better equipped than politics to to the task ahead of us. So I decided to write a novel. I almost reached retirement age before taking a crack at fiction writing, but here I am.
Introduce us to the fictional rural setting here, the town of Faith, located near real-world Colby. Tell us a little about your community this is centered around.
Yeah, you know, Faith is about halfway between two very real places. It's a fictional community, but it's situated between two very real communities, Loyal and Unity, mm-hmm. In Clark County. And as you say, not far from Colby. And, you know, Faith is a struggling small town. It's beleaguered. People are definitely struggling there. And some are giving up hope. But also, like any small town, you know, there's tremendous pride in the community, and there's, a stubbornness about making sure that the community moves forward. But there's also stratification. There are people who are well off. There are
people on the hill and the rest of everybody.
Yeah, and there's actually a place called The Hill, which is based on a very real place from my childhood, where the doctors or lawyers or the people who are sort of the business owners, that's where they live. And then there are the outcasts. And this novel is really about outcasts and how they're seen, how they're judged, how they're treated as a result, and how they also have remarkable abilities that often are overlooked or ignored or not even seen at all. But they have the capacity to work wonders, and outcasts in this story really do come to the rescue of this struggling community.
Your main character, Ray, is one of those outcasts in a lot of ways, doesn't fit in a lot of ways because of race, his family background, other things we learn throughout the story as well. And I think often the story then is, hey, I don't fit into this small town, so I'm going to go. I'm going to go to the Twin Cities. I'm going to go to Madison, Milwaukee, New York City, whatever. And that is not the answer for Ray and a lot of the other characters. They find ways to build lives in this small town. This seems important to me in what you're doing with this book. Talk about that a little.
Well, you know, it is easy for people who feel ostracized or feel like outsiders to just pack up and leave and go someplace else where they figure they'll be welcome. But the thing is, for Ray, family's there, friends are there, everything that Ray cares about is there. And so Ray's stubborn and decides to make a go of it right there. Ray's got some surprises that are revealed toward the end of the book.
We won't spoil that.
But, you know, this is a story about how we're no darn good at looking below the surface. We look at what's on the surface and we judge people by outward appearance. And we're no darn good at understanding what's going on underneath and what marvels, what wonders exist underneath. And if we would only look under that surface, there's some remarkable capacities there, and raise a testimony to that.
Another way you want to look below the surface, I think, and you've talked about this before, this novel is we can't look at rural Wisconsin, rural anywhere, as a monolith where everybody is the same, whether that's a negative view from the outside or the positive small town values from the inside. Your characters, the people in the town of Faith, they're encountering situations, they react to them differently. They each have their own story about how they relate to these things.
Yeah, if anything, this book is about shattering that myth that rural communities are monoliths. There's a line in the book. Everybody thinks everybody knows everybody in small towns, and everybody's wrong. People are complicated, and they're no less complicated in small rural communities as they are anywhere else. And there are people who are really well off. There are people who are dirt poor, and there are people who are highly successful, and there are people who are failing miserably and struggling mightily. And yet sometimes the people who have been pushed aside or discounted end up having some of the most remarkable capabilities and can come to the rescue when things really go awry.
Another thing that happens a lot in your book is you mentioned there's family there for Ray and other characters. Sometimes that family relationship is rocky. For some of the characters, it's horrible. But a lot of what's happening here is finding family. Not necessarily biological family. Ray ends up calling an older couple, Grandma and Grandpa, about midway through the book. Yep. Finding our people. That's something that can happen in small towns or big cities, all points in between.
Yeah, it has to happen for people, regardless of where they live. And sometimes family arrangements are ugly. Sometimes they're just complicated, but sometimes they're really painful, and that means people have to find connection where they can find it, and Ray does that with remarkable effect. And you know, this book in a lot of ways was inspired by my late brother Dan. You know, I don't know where I'd be or who I would be if I hadn't grown up in Dan's shadow. He was just by accident of birth. He had some neurological damage at birth that led to all kinds of facial twitching and facial tics, and had very unsightly growths on his face. So you can imagine what he then faced in school, relentlessly bullied, tormented, physically abused. And I watched all that sometimes from a distance, sometimes from up quite close. And the remarkable thing about Dan is that even though he had all kinds of reasons to curl up in a ball, to sort of let a shell build around him and not let people in, he became probably one of the friendliest and most open and accepting people I have ever met, which was a genuine inspiration, because he was sort of treated as a, you know, a throwaway human being, as refuse. And yet he really rose above that, and in adulthood was as friendly and as accepting as anybody I've ever encountered. And that spirit is a spirit that I tried to bring into the book. And I wouldn't have had this story to tell if I hadn't had Dan as a brother.
Talking to Mike McCabe about his new novel. It's set in rural Wisconsin. It's called Miracles Along County Q. Mike, as you say, it's set in the real world. There is definitely an element of magical realism, the divine. It's called Miracles are in the title, the opening line. What can't be explained is magic. Talk a little bit about the supernatural element to your book.
Well, you know, I think we like to think that we can explain everything, and that we can figure anything out and come up with a logical explanation for anything. In reality, we need to be a little bit more humble than that. There are things that are just difficult to understand or impossible to explain. And I do use what you describe as magical realism. There are very true, very real events and people who appear in this book. But there is also the element of the supernatural, because there is a limit to what human understanding can explain. There's a lot that we still have to learn about each other and about life, and this book sort of celebrates that fact that we've got a lot still to figure out.
And whether we're talking about it as a supernatural thing or a psychological thing, one of my big takeaways from the book is the healing power of empathy, of understanding other people, of putting yourself in their perspectives. Am I right in seeing that as something you were really highlighting here?
Oh, absolutely. I think if the book were to be summed up in one sentence, I guess what I would say, I could do it in three words, kindness, I guess it's four, kindness is a superpower.
And that, I don't want to give away too much of the magical realism here, that's maybe literally true for our main character, but you see this as a metaphor, I think, for what we can do in the real world. Expand on that.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, that takes me back to my memories of my late brother. He endured a lot, more than anybody should have to endure, certainly far more than I ever had to endure. It was painful watching, but it changed me. It transformed me forever. made me a different person than I fear I would have become otherwise had I not grown up in his shadow. But he, even though he was subjected to a lot of cruelty, he found a way, a path to kindness. And he treated people with a kindness that they probably didn't deserve sometimes, given the way society treated him. But that had a powerful effect on me. So right there was an example of somebody who rose above pain and was still able to show kindness to people. And that was his superpower. That was his ability to transform me. My life was changed forever because I had him as a brother. I lost him when he was only 47 years old. He died of colon cancer. But we were very, very close, even though we were completely different. But we were very close. And he taught me a lot about life. And to me, that was an example of somebody who possessed true superpowers.
In the town of faith, a lot of what we lately call culture war issues are lurking in the fringes, directly confronted at some points. Think of anything you've seen in the news. It's coming up there. And getting back to your point of some things can't be solved in a capital, a lot of times when we're talking about these issues, it's our side against their side and big, broad views. Talk a little bit about the value of dealing with this as people, one-to-one in a way.
Yeah, that's the thing that is so troubling about our current moment is we are so prone to demonizing others. One side looks at the other as absolutely evil, not just wrong, not just people we may disagree with, but we actually see them as evil. And of course, even in a small town, that entire spectrum is covered. You've got people who are living very different lives, and you know, we tend to think about rural communities as people are just all the same, but they're not. Anybody who's ever actually lived in a small community knows that there's a tremendous range of different kinds of people. And they look, some are looking down on others, some really despise certain neighbors or certain others in the community. And if we're going to live together, and certainly if we're going to prosper as a society, we have to make changes inside us. We can't expect those problems to be solved on Capitol Hill. Once our society makes a change, that will be reflected in our politics, not the other way around. The change isn't going to come through political action and then society is going to be transformed. No, I think society will make change and then that change will end up being reflected in our politics. And right now what's being reflected in our politics is our tendency to you know, sometimes be downright delusional. We're dishonest with ourselves about so many things. We're denying so many things that are true. And then we're demonizing other people. We're sowing the seeds of division. We're even dehumanizing people. We're seeing them as less than human. And we've got to confront that. And those are matters of the heart. And when we change them in our hearts, the politics will reflect that.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
That's Mike McCabe, former journalist in Wisconsin, longtime former executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. He was with us today to share his new novel set in rural Wisconsin. It's called Miracles Along County Q. Had a couple conversations lately about crafting, including yesterday's chat about folk art and tribal craft projects. That got me thinking. I know a lot of WPR listeners do really cool hands-on hobbies, so we want to hear about yours. Do you do some kind of hands-on craft, quilting or woodworking, pottery or needlepoint? Maybe something mechanical or high-tech, restoring an antique car or truck, building your own computers, you name it. We want to hear about it. Call and leave a message at 888-642-0232. You can text that same number, 888-642-0232, or you can send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Tell us about your hands-on hobby, and we can share it on a future show. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.